Hello, this is Lynette Evans. I work in the School of Psychological Science at La Trobe University, and this is La Trobe University's podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to a La Trobe University podcast. I'm Matt Smith, and today we'll be talking about...
I'm talking about chocolate.
That's right, we'll be talking about the history of chocolate, and with me is this person.
Okay, so I'm Emma Robertson, and I'm a lecturer in history at La Trobe University, and I'm based at the Bendigo campus.
Because when you think about it, chocolate's had a long and colourful history, mostly brown, but still colourful. Way back in 1959, for example, they were advertising chocolate like this.
Dad says he can pick his favourite chocolate blindfolded. Was it that one? No? Try this one. That's it. No mistaking it. That's Nestle's. Try the blindfold test. Prove Nestle's best.
N-E-S-T-L-E-S. Nestle's one of the very best chocolate.
So there you have it. Selling chocolate while talking in a transatlantic accent. So we've gone all the way from that in 1950... to nowadays, where we sell chocolate by having a gorilla play a Phil Collins drum solo. Now that's a lot of change in 50 years, so if you go back even further, how different has chocolate been over that time? If you took a bar from now and took it back then, would they recognise it? Would it look the same? What would they think of it?
Ooh, yeah, good question. I mean, I think the product chocolate has undergone a lot of changes, particularly in terms of the branding and the marketing of chocolate. Especially solid chocolate, that eating chocolate has just really changed. So a couple of hundred years ago, I mean, really before the First World War, chocolate was really mainly a drink, and it only really starts to really take off as a solid chocolate. I mean, it's around in the 19th century and even before, but it really takes off in the 20th century. And you have so many now different permutations of it. They're always bringing out a new kind of, I think it's Aero Bubbles now or something like that. They've got new types of products coming out all the time. So I think that would be very, very different. And just the branding of it, the way in which companies have tried to differentiate this one product, chocolate, by giving it different names, different advertising, different associations as well. The earlier chocolate was quite unpalatable. It was... they used to add things to it to make it more palatable. So the early chocolate, they didn't know how to extract all the cocoa fat from it. So it was could be quite greasy. And if you made it as a drink, you'd have this sort of scum on the top. So they used to try and add things to it, like starch and things, to make it a more palatable product. So there are a lot of scandals around the kind of things they were adding to chocolate in the 19th century. So that by the sort of 1870s, 80s, there are people like Cadbury saying, no, our chocolate is absolutely pure. We have this new process, the Van Houten process, which now extract all this horrible fat, and we can use that to make eating chocolate, and now we have a pure product. So I think there's been a lot of changes in terms of how chocolate's made, and now particularly just in terms of the marketing and the branding, essentially the same product has come to have so many different meanings really as well, from a romantic gift of a box of chocolates to an energy giving bar, things like this. There's just so many different meanings that I think it would be very, very different to look at chocolate from today.
So where did the attraction come from to eat it then? Why was it, if they were cutting it badly, if there was negative connotations to it, why was there a desire for it?
I mean, it starts out as a luxury product. Like if you've got the time to make it and produce a reasonably palatable drink, and it was expensive at first as well. So it was very much a sort of elite drink. And I think that has its own sort of appeal for the people that are drinking it, that you go to coffee houses of the 18th century, and it was an elite drink then. It comes to have associations of being something that's quite a wholesome drink. I mean, at first it starts out as a medicinal drink because it really isn't that nice, and they're trying to market it in that way. But it becomes have more and more associations of this is something that's fairly nutritious. And the Quaker manufacturers really sort of, particularly from the mid-19th century, become involved in producing it and see it as an alternative to alcohol as a drink. And it's something more substantial than tea or coffee. But then once they learn how to make this more palatable, it's a food substitute. It's something that can be seen as health-giving for the working classes, that it's something nutritious. So they start to market it in that way, and that's how it seems to take off. And you even have chocolate rations for the Navy. They start to sort of help the industry along a little bit in that way. So I think it's complicated how it develops and why it becomes such an attractive product. I mean, clearly the addition of sugar is very important because making it a sweeter product, the development in manufacturing helps it to become a more appealing product.
It ties in closely to stories of empire. How important was this as I suppose a symbol of the success of the empire, and also for revenue, I suppose, as well?
the way in which the cocoa beans are grown needs a tropical climate to grow the cocoa. So as the European countries are expanding into Africa, they start to try and grow cocoa in Africa as well. And the British, for Britain, which I've been looking at, they grow in British West Africa, in Ghana and Nigeria particularly. This does become a very important source of supply for British chocolate factories. In that sense, it's an important part. But I think the empire associations of chocolate in terms of the cultural history of chocolate become lost quite quickly, really, in the British chocolate industry. So where it had been a product of the British West Indies, originally in the Caribbean and sort of South and Central America, and it moves to West Africa and it just sort of seems to lose that sense of it being an empire product. A product like tea keeps its associations with tea plantations, and you often see that in the marketing, whereas chocolate becomes very much associated with, particularly the sort of majority of chocolate, with white working class consumption. And you often lose that sense of it being an empire product. It becomes very much a British product, and I think people aren't necessarily aware of its tropical origins so much. The meanings of it change from being a tropical elite consumer product to being something that's for the white working classes, and it's an industrially produced chocolate which becomes quite divorced from its tropical origins.
Did it make this transition quickly? Because it seems like that would also take it out of a luxury item as well.
Yeah, so I think the things coalesced. The industrial manufacture, the cheapening of the cocoa itself, these things kind of come together, particularly into the early 20th century. You start to see that I think it becomes much more of a mass consumer product, and then it's losing its associations as a tropical good.
The way that we perceive how chocolate should be manufactured now is probably a lot more awareness on the manufacturing process just in itself. How does that affect chocolate and how it's perceived?
In my research, I've looked at sort of two elements of chocolate production. I've looked at the cocoa farming and also the industrial manufacture of chocolate. Slave-grown cocoa kind of moved away from that officially by the later 19th century and 20th century. So the farmers in the British West Africa are usually, I say small-scale, it's probably not quite accurate, but they're sort of independent farmers, really. They're farming cocoa on their own farms rather than on plantations. Cocoa doesn't actually do very well as a plantation crop. So you have whole families that will work their farm and produce cocoa and other crops. And then the British manufacturers, Cadbury Fry and Rowntree, get together to buy cocoa from those farmers through their own buying agents in West Africa. So that's already a change. And there's some anxieties around that they've lost sort of the control that they had through plantation grown cocoa, and that this is now they're having to deal with farmers sort of individually, and they feel like they've lost control of the agriculture, and there's a begrudging respect for how well these West African farmers actually do in the industry, and that they are able to grow cocoa really, really successfully. So I think there's an interesting shift there from slave grown cocoa to then really predominantly cocoa grown by West African farmers. Even in the early 20th century, there's still scandals around Rowntree's and Cadbury's and Fry buying cocoa from the Portuguese West African colonies, which still seem to have, although it's called indentured labour, it's essentially a system of slavery. So there's still scandals around slave-grown cocoa. And you'll know, even recently, we've had scandals around particularly child labour in the West African industry, and firms like Cadbury's having sort of engaged with those challenging issues about what are the labour conditions in these farms. So I think that there has been a shift in terms of cocoa farming. But in terms of the industrial manufacture, which I think has been interesting how that's developed, I've really focused on Britain, and you have those big firms, Cadbury, Rowntree and Fry, with big chocolate factories employing a lot of people. I mean, Rowntree's in Europe had over 10,000 people working at it, but over half of those were women. So they really do develop this large-scale mass manufacture of chocolate. That's interesting now in terms of how chocolate has become, again, I think, almost an elite substance in some ways, and that we're quite interested in the artisan kind of chocolate, small scale produced chocolate. There's again that resurgence of interest in where is the cocoa coming from, and you'll see cocoa marketed with the exact sort of plantation where it's been grown, or there's an interest in the origins of it. Obviously fair trade as well, that there's a desire now to have fair trade, but also I think in the how it's manufactured, that there's this sort of, again, a growth in small scale chocolate manufacturers. And in York, in England, where I'm from, you have still Nestlé, which is now the big firm there, but you have lots of small shops growing up with people producing, handmade chocolate. So I think it's interesting how it's kind of come back around to that artisan produced chocolate and away from the industrial manufactured chocolate.
It's a window into how many industries function, though, and the evolution of many industries. I mean, you could say the same kind of thing for, very much for coffee is coming to mind, as far as plantations and the manufacture of it. But even, organic fruits and vegetables.
There is a lot of connections in terms of, I think, food politics generally, about how we feel about food and how it's made. What I find interesting about chocolate is the sort of extent of processing that it undergoes, which I think is something slightly different to something like coffee, in that there's so much that gets done to chocolate, to the cocoa beans, once they kind of arrive in the factory. So I think that I'm interested in that in terms of it had become very much an industrialized product. And I'm interested in the change of that in the factories that I've looked at, from hand, where women would sit literally dipping by hand chocolates, to sitting by a manufacturing assembly line and just piping one design onto chocolate as it goes past. And I think those industrialized processes really interest me, in that how it becomes, it's a food, but it's also so much that is done to it in that sense.
You've spoken a couple of times about the women in factories. You've got a personal connection to this, don't you?
Yeah, so that's how this project for me really started, in that I grew up in the city of York, so northern English city, and the two key industries are chocolate and the railway. So quite a few generations of my family have been in the city, so they usually either worked in chocolate or railways. And so a lot of the women in my family had worked at Rowntree's. Rowntree's and Terry's were the big firms. Rowntree's famous for Kit Kat, and Terry's Chocolate Orange, which you still have in Australia, I see. And my gran started at Terry's initially. She worked there for a bit, and then she went over to Rowntree's. And there's some nice rivalry in Europe between whether you worked at Terry's and Rowntree's and who was the best workers.
That's going to be a sequel to West Side Story at some point. So tell me about, if you don't mind, a bit of the personal history then. What kind of stories did you hear about these factories?
There were so many interesting stories, particularly about women who had maybe just gone into factory work for the first time. One of the women I spoke to, called Lillian, she was one of the oldest women that I spoke to, and she was working in Terry's in the 1920s and then went to Rowntree's. And she went to Rowntree's as a newly married woman, but she was trying to work to support her husband, who had diabetes, and she needed to pay for medicine at the time, and was really shocked by some of the behaviour that she saw. She felt she was very much an innocent, and the women were talking about all sorts of things and sort of teasing her and swearing, and she used to get quite upset and used to be in tears when she used to go home. She was so sort of shocked and felt so out of place. And her husband said, give it up, it's fine. She says, no, I'm going to keep going. And then she says she just became more confident. And so she just sort of really felt that she changed by working there. Things that would go on, little jokes that they would play on each other, and chatting, just talking. And again, singing. They used to sing sometimes when they were working. Sometimes women would just sing themselves, or at certain points they would actually play music in the factory and they would sing along to the records, and they had little romances. They would say if their record came on, they would wave across to their boyfriend who might be across the room. And so, yeah, just I think these nice moments of a very, at least for some women, a very social and friendly space. For some women, it wasn't the case, and they actually felt excluded from that. And so they might talk about feeling a bit left out of some of that sort of camaraderie, as some of them talked about.
It seems like it was very much a kind of women's domain, though. They treated it like their own personal space, and this is a space where we can be ourselves.
Yeah, I think the way in which the work was organised fostered that, in that women's and men's work were kept quite separate. There were certain jobs that were seen very much as women's work. So decorating the chocolate, packing chocolate was very much seen as a women's job. So you would have groups of a lot of women at one point on the factory floor, with very few men in that room, maybe just bringing in new packing materials or bringing in trays of chocolate. And so you do have nice stories from the men that work there about being a little bit terrified to go into these rooms full of women who are all quite, noisy and talking and, maybe teasing them. And so, yeah, the way in which the work was organised, I think, created these women's spaces, really.
So has it created a line of strong women in your family then?
Oh, yeah, I think, yeah, there have some strong women in my family who worked at Rowntree's, definitely. It was nice to talk to them about their experiences of factory work and, what they'd got out of it. I mean, not all women would say this, but certainly they were very proud of the work that they'd done and very proud of of Rowntree's as a company. So my aunt would always say, you know, Rowntree's is York, or was York, as she put it. It's now been taken over. But I think she felt that the city and the factory were very much connected, and that someone that grew up in York, you know, this was part of her heritage. And she would do the packing the boxes, make boxes, do the ribbons and make them beautiful. And she would say, you know, these would go to royalty. They were making these products that she was really, really proud of. And she became, a charge hand eventually. She was sort of supervising other women. And her mum, who was my grand, worked there actually around the same time, which is quite interesting. It must have been interesting for them. My mum didn't last very long. She worked in the post office sort of section of the factory, but I don't think she was there too long. But yeah, there's some good stories. And
would you say that that kind of connection changes the chocolate? It'd have an extra significance, say, yeah, when it's that much of a process involved in making it compared to now where it's a lot more just factory pressing.
Yeah, I think I know my gran talked about Black Magic, a chocolate assortment that Rowntree's used to make, and she used to do the panned piping. So she would pipe designs onto the chocolate to sort of show you whether it was an orange cream or a coffee cream. And she said to me, you know, it's never, when I look at a box of Black Magic now, it's not the same as when they were hand piped. So she really did have that sense that they just weren't the same chocolates because they were produced in a different way, and you didn't have that connection to the chocolate. So yeah, for her, the chocolate was different and had lost that sense of connection. So I think, yeah, mechanisation did change the work and the product for women. One of the things I was really interested in that didn't really occur to me when I was doing interviews with women workers at the time, but later on I was thinking about them as consumers. And when I went back to listen to the interviews, it was interesting how many women talked about eating at the factory. And actually, one of the women told me she would put a handful of chocolates into her pocket and that would kind of last her through a shift. I think other women would say, you know, they didn't want to eat chocolate after that. For some women, yeah, they did. They enjoyed consuming chocolate. They weren't always supposed to. There was a nice story about a supervisor who had confronted one woman and said, are you eating, Mrs. So-and-so? And the woman had said, yes, do you want one? And just gave her, like, just presented her with this enormous tray full of chocolates. And this was a story that Lily, who I mentioned before, was telling me. She was sort of she said it was a real eye-opener to see someone doing that, to stand up to authority in that way. It does give it extra meaning, I think, as a product.
What does chocolate mean to you then?
Ooh, well, research and something very pleasurable to eat. I have this sort of conflicting thing where I'll spend a day looking at chocolate adverts and it's just, oh, I'm so hungry, I just want to go and eat some chocolate. I do love chocolate. I enjoy eating chocolate. And I am just sort of fascinated by it, though. I think it has become such a sort of cliche about, you know, women loving chocolate that you sort of want to resist it as well. But yeah, I think researching it is an interesting thing to do, because people are always saying, oh, you know, you must get lots of free samples and all this kind of thing. And I think in some ways, chocolate itself, the actual commodity, is something that I'm interested less than the things that go around that. So the labour, the marketing, the cultural meanings attached to it are more interesting to me than the chocolate.
My thanks to my guest today, Dr. Emma Robertson. She's from the history program at La Trobe University at the Bendigo campus, and she's also the author of Chocolate, Women and Empire, A Social and Cultural History. And that was published by Manchester University Press in 2009. A big shout out also to Ivan Burge, and my thanks for helping me record this podcast. That's a so long from me, and thanks for listening.